Stephen Schubert here with the Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory. Well, the monsoon trough is still bringing heavy rain across the Top End, which is good news for some, but not if you're a meat worker. The Australian Agricultural Company has temporarily sent their workers home from its abattoir at Livingston due to a lack of cattle.
Probably about 300 that are currently employed at the Livingston plant. So it's a considerable amount of people. They'll be stood down without pay until they can recommence work.
So one downside to the beautiful wet weather that we've been getting on across the Top End. We'll have more on that story and plenty more on the Country Hour. First though, let's take a look around Australia with National Rural News.
There's fires in the east and floods in the west. Let's look at what this all means for farmers. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington. Let's start in western New South Wales, where people have this morning gathered at Coolah to hear there's still a threat of danger from a major bushfire. Michael Kavanagh is there for the Country Hour.
Several hundred farmers and townsfolk have packed the sports club for a bushfire update. Those that have spilled outside are confronted with a heavy smoke haze enveloping the small hamlet of 900 people. Farmers have been told it's not safe to return to homes and properties. Stock losses, which are expected to be huge, are being assessed. Vets are now preparing to go onto properties for the euthanising of animals. Michael Kavanagh, ABC.
As the fires continue, a Cootamundra stock contractor is organising a fodder drive to help farmers who have lost their grazing country. Andrew Glover says he hopes to send 10 truckloads of feed to farmers this Saturday.
From what we've been able to gather off social media and a few conversations is we've got some friends up there that look like they may have lost everything, house and all. So that's been pretty hard to take because we're down here not being able to help. So this is the way we're trying to get around it.
Okay, let's head across the country now, and farmers in Western Australia's Great Southern are assessing the damage of flooding that washed through the region at the weekend. Tyne Logan has the details.
It's been a chaotic weekend, with downpours of over 200 millimetres recorded since Thursday for some areas in the southeast of the state. A 68-year-old man has died near Esperance, and the search is still on for a 74-year-old man whose car was found abandoned. Roads have been destroyed, bridges have collapsed. In Newdigate, 200 kilometres east of Narrogin, grain and sheep farmer Ann Bishop says they've had minor stock losses, but the major costs will now be infrastructure and feed.
There's just lake extending from one side to the other, all at fence level. We can just see the top of the fences poking out through the water.
Authorities say the towns that have been severely impacted will now be going into recovery mode.
We have more on the floods and fires on our ABC Rural homepage right now. Just lastly on weather-related news, and frost has taken the shine off South Australia's bumper grain harvest. Mid-North agricultural consultant Mick Faulkner estimates frost has cost SA farmers about $300 million this year, making it the single biggest impact on yields.
I think there's a lot of hurt. It's the most hurt I've seen for a long, long time to have something snatched away. And I guess farmers are not always that empathetic towards each other. And so people who have had very, very high yields and high incomes this year don't really understand, or perhaps in some ways it's worse than that, and don't really care about the others who have had it snatched away at the last minute.
The government has moved to abolish the dispute mediation in horticulture after a review found it was inefficient and ignored by both growers and traders. In official response to the review of the Horticulture Code, Assistant Agriculture Minister Anne Ruston says it will be replaced by a system that is independent, fast and flexible. She says all of horticulture should be brought under the code, and she'll move to give the ACCC more powers to rapidly respond to breaches. Australian wool growers are being told to play to their strengths in order to avoid competition from other wool-growing countries. Analysts predict that the supply of broader types of wool will increase worldwide, and that will mean prices will soften over the next few years. And then Robert Ryan, the managing director of Shute Bell, says any move away from white wool will open the door to global pressures.
They need to be very careful about the breeds. Don't go for the quick exotic breed. Go for the traditional first cross Merino ewe over with a border or a pole Dorset or something like that that's going to give you white wool. Because a lot of countries produce wool and a lot of it's got black fibre or medulated fibre in it, and that's something in Australia we need to be very, very careful that we move away from.
To Research News now, and a former British chief scientist is worried that politicians are ignoring the science of climate change in developing things like energy policy and GM crops. Sir John Beddington says increases in urban populations mean there's a greater need for energy, water and food at a time when climate change is forcing more natural weather disasters. He says the GM debate is just one example of how politics is holding back progress.
I think there's a danger in the scientific community of feeling that we know more and we know better than the common people. That is not a sensible position for scientists to have. What is a sensible position is to insist that this is the scientific evidence. You may not like it, but that is the evidence.
And an international team of researchers have mapped the quinoa genome in a move that they say will help breeders develop better varieties. Australian quinoa growers say whilst the plant is extremely salt and drought tolerant, it doesn't cope with the heat stresses or waterlogging. University of Melbourne researcher Ute Rossiner worked on the genome sequencing project and says selective breeding programs will be the next step.
To improve crop quality, crop performance, adapted to all kinds of environment across the globe. Particularly what people are interested in is to reduce the bitter taste.
Bitter quinoa, there's nothing worse. And for more rural news, you can head online to abc.net.au/rural.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Stephen Schubert and I am going to be with you on The Country Hour for the entirety of this week. Thank you so much for your company. Well, today, windmills. They are a thing that I always used to count on long family road trips to pass the time, but are they a thing of the past? One cattle station near Alice Springs is pulling down their windmills. We'll be finding out why. And we'll also be talking about that story we heard in National Rural News, for a prominent scientist in Britain is urging politicians to take science a bit more seriously. All of that and, of course, the latest weather and market details coming up on The Country Hour. First today, though, the Australian Agricultural Company's abattoir at Livingston has been shut down for a few weeks due to a lack of supply of cattle. It's all because of heavy rain across the territory, with most cattle stations unable to muster and many properties cut off. But it's the first time the facility, 50 kilometres south of Darwin, has had to shut down. AACo's Managing Director Jason Strong says it expects production will be down for this week only.
We've taken a couple of days off from processing from Friday, so and we won't process this week, and as everyone would realise, it's related to the amount of rain that we're having in the north, and everyone's aware that obviously there's a pretty intense sort of rainfall period in the early part of the year up there, and we've always planned around how do we manage supply into the plant at this time of year. We started operating on the 9th of January, and things have been going pretty well, but as everyone knows, the rain's kept coming, and just to make sure we can properly manage supply into the plant and keep things going consistently, we've made the decision to not operate this week.
Do you have any idea how long the shutdown will last for?
Yeah, we are, at this stage, we don't expect it to be this week, so unless something significantly changes, but that's our current plan, and we obviously monitor it daily. We've got cattle supply lined up for the plant, and we want to be up and running as soon as we can as well, but want to make sure we can do that in a sustainable way for keeping the plant running, but also so we can give the staff consistent work as well. So at this stage, we're just planning on the work.
What's it mean for your workers? How many people are out of work for the week?
Depends on which part of the plant is. Obviously, we've still got some maintenance, and it gives us a chance to do a few of those things around the plant. But we don't normally get a chance to do in one hit. But some of the operational staff, of course, will have the week off, and we obviously want to get them back to work as soon as we can.
I understand this is the first time that the plant has had to shut down since it's been operational, and there was a lot of talk about trying to make it as weatherproof as possible. What's different about this weather event that this is the first time it's had to shut down?
I think, Steve, this is the second wet season we've been through, and we're running at a full shift. And I don't think there's a lot different. I think there's been quite a bit of extra rain this year compared to what there was last year in some of the supply areas. So I think just managing that carefully. And as I said, this is just the second wet season. So as we learn more about how accessible some of the properties and operations are where we get cattle supply from, we'll get better and better at this. But our intention, as it always was, still remains the same, to get up and running as soon as we can in the new year and keep operating. But we have to be sensible about managing that supply in line with the weather as it plays out. And as we know, it's been pretty wet, so we're just managing that as well as we can.
Northern abattoirs having to shut down over the wet season is nothing new, but was it a bit too ambitious from AAECO maybe to try to create a facility that was aiming to keep open for most of the year?
No, we don't think so. And having a seasonal shutdown of a number of months, as plants might have done traditionally, is quite different to having a week off when it's really wet. So I think the plan's still very solid and execution of it's still going fine, and I think it's a very different situation to a plant not even being open again yet from the wet season. So we work right up until Christmas, and like I said, we started on the 9th of January, so I think the approach has worked well, and we expect that to continue to be the case, and it's certainly our commitment to have a consistently operating facility for the year.
What's this going to mean for the people, your customers? Is this going to interfere with contracts?
No, it's only a week's production. We manage our customers very closely, and we plan that on a forward basis, so we can certainly respond. And before we make any decision like this, we're conscious of both the input and output side, so the cattle supply, the staff, and also the customers. So all of that's been managed, no problem.
AAECO Managing Director Jason Strong. Now, the Australian Meat Industry Employees Union says it thinks the shutdown will be at least 2 weeks long and that employees won't have any wages until that happens when production gets going again. I spoke to Matt Giorno from the union a short time ago, who says the shutdown will be tough on his members.
Yeah, probably about 300 that are currently employed at the Livingston plant. So it's a considerable amount of people.
Are they getting paid at the moment?
No, they'll be stood down without pay until they can recommence work.
What percentage of the workforce would be in your union, and what are your members saying to you?
I don't have those exact figures, Steve, but certainly a large percentage of the workers up there are in our union. And the workers obviously are concerned with the current situation. The plant's been open about 18 months and they haven't experienced a stand down in the past. But unfortunately, Darwin is in the tropics and these weather events will happen.
Have you been working with the company at all? Has this always been expected in their business model for the Livingston Abattoir?
Livingston Abattoir, to a degree, or to a large degree, Steve, has really sort of flood-proofed their business, I suppose. And they did anticipate that there would be a regular supply of cattle over the 52 weeks of the year. Unfortunately, or fortunately, if you're a producer, this wet season's been exceptional and it's sort of thrown a bit of a spanner in the works as far as that goes.
But surely if you're one of those 300 workers without a paycheck coming in for a few weeks, you've got to be hurting with that.
For sure, Steve. Obviously, those people are doing it tough. There's no two ways about it. But unfortunately, it is a feature of the industry. And there are other plants that haven't even opened from their Christmas shutdown as yet.
Right, so if you are working in an abattoir in the north of Australia, you have to expect to lose at least a couple of weeks of work in a big wet.
You do. It's a feature of the industry, and the old Point Stewart Abattoir and places like that really only worked for 6 months of the year. Fortunately, the more modern facilities that are at Livingston will extend that, but unfortunately there will be weather events that prevent cattle from being able to be brought to the abattoir.
And of course, if it does keep raining, there's a chance that this shutdown could extend for an indefinite amount of time.
There is a possibility that it could be extended, but typically Darwin weather by the end of February does improve. So I'm hopeful that things will improve in the near future. Really, I just hope it stops raining soon and those people can get back to work and start earning a paycheck again.
Matt Giorno from the Australian Meat Industry Employees Union. And if you are a worker at the Livingston Abattoir, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a bell on 1300 057 222 or send us a text message on 0487 99 1057. You are listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory. After the Cat Empire, we'll be hearing about how the wet weather's impacting on the lemon harvest around the Katherine region.
Some evil in my eye and some thoughts in my head that were making me feel high. On my head was a hoodie, in my ears was some bass. I was walking by my dog when I saw that sexy face come towards me. With a little cheeky smile, if she was a phone, I'd pick her up and dial the fire brigade. On 000, she stole me my tracks. I said, I'm oh, hello, hello. Oh, hello, hello. Sleeping in the sand with some dreams in my head that were causing an extension to the towel and my bed. And the waves were rolling like the curves on those legs, like that sweet beach pillow with a centerfold spread. In the midst of the slumber, heard some footsteps are creeping, and I woke to discover the woman I've been dreaming. She knelt down beside, said, can I share your pillow? I rolled over and I said, well, hello, hello. Some like cars and some like the houses with the rooftop spires, and some like the gossip about some rich sugar daddies. But me and my friends were like the golden brown honeys, and some like watching people living on TV. That's a little strange if you're asking me, cause I like to eat and laugh and play. And all these are the things I know. Well, hello, hello. Oh, hello, hello. Ah, hello, hello.
The Cat Empire on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's also been a wet start to the only commercial lemon harvest in the Top End. Pickers have been out in the rain under wet trees on Seven Fields' Katherine Orchard for the past few weeks. Harvest Supervisor Emma Harrison says despite all the rain, it's been a good start.
We've done a size pick on all the three blocks at the moment. So anything that's over 60 millimetres we've picked. And we're just waiting on the next lot to size up. Hopefully next Monday after we do this quick grapefruit pick, we'll get going on the lemons again and finish them off for the season. So hopefully we'll be all done by the end of February.
There's been a lot of rain around Katherine in the last few weeks. What's it been like trying to pick in amongst all those storms?
Yeah, we've had a lot of rain. The trees are absolutely soaked, so the pickers get wet as soon as they start picking in the morning. We keep going through it, and it's great that we've got fantastic pickers that keep trudging through and pick it even though that they're drenched. But if it starts to get too heavy, we have to stop, unfortunately.
Is it hard to keep the morale up of the pickers to keep them working when it is such drizzly conditions?
We do weekly challenges and stuff with our pickers to keep them motivated. They all understand that it needs to happen, whether it's going to be them or someone else, so they get down and do it, and they understand that this is a rainy season. It's always going to rain, so unfortunately we've just got to deal with that.
What does all the downpours do to the trees and the fruit?
The fruit is really full of water at the moment because of the rain. The trees just soak it all up and put it straight into the fruit. So for us, it means that we have to pick them with a lot more care, because otherwise we get bruising and marks and stuff from the fruit. So that's why we use the machines rather than picking into bags and things like that.
Taking the water up into the fruit, what does that do to the size?
We sort of need it for it to rain and then the sun to come out for a little while for it to size up. Other than that, it just keeps them at the rate they are. If we need the trees to work a little bit in the sun, get some heat out to them, and then that's when they size up a fair amount.
So these overcast conditions that we have today aren't helping a lot?
No, they'll still help a little bit. Everything is always growing constantly, but yeah, hot sunny days is what we need to size up quickly.
What's all this rain meant for the soil drainage?
All right, our soil here on the farm is from the river, apparently, all these years ago. It's soil from the river, so our soil drains really quickly. It's not too bad for our tractors and everything. They don't, it soaks in, so they don't have much puddles or anything to work with, which is fantastic for us. It makes it a life a lot easier.
What's this wet season been like to past ones here in the last few years?
Last year we didn't get much rain at all during January and February. So this year, having over 400 mils has meant that we have to take more care when we're picking and stuff like that. But as we're used to it, it's what happens with the wet season. Sometimes we get a lot, sometimes it's just periods every now and then. So this year, having a lot just meant that we have to be extra careful.
What is the quality of the lemons looking like?
Quality is good at the moment, as long as we keep the oleo and stuff down when we're picking them, which is being as gentle as we can. Our quality's going all right, and the market seems to be really good, I've heard, so that's good for us as well.
And the oleo is marking and damaging that can be got while picking?
Yeah, oleo is damaging the cells on the skin of the fruit, so it causes like a bruise or a brown mark. That happens if they get dropped or if our lemons have to be in water within 6 seconds once they're picked. Otherwise, the picker's fingerprints and stuff can show up, so that's something that we have to contend with. Teaching the pickers to get it in the water on the machine as quick as possible is the hardest thing, but they all seem to get the hang of it now, so it's easier for us.
Where do the lemons head off to once they leave the farm here?
Our lemons go to the packing shed, which is in town in Catherine for us. They then get degreened for, I think it's about 5 days, they stay in the degreening room. And then get packed into boxes once they're nice and yellow and looking fantastic, and then off to the markets or to the supermarkets. So if you see Sunwest lemons in supermarkets, they're ours.
Emma Harrison, Harvest Supervisor at Seven Fields Farm near Catherine, speaking to our Catherine reporter, Dan Fitzgerald. The former chief scientist of the United Kingdom is warning Australia and the United States' attitude towards climate change is highly dangerous. Sir John Beddington is here to address a national conference on agriculture and resource economics and says food researchers are among the most affected. He told Serena Locke the anti-GM attitude in Europe, along with climate change scepticism, have global effects, particularly if we are to increase food production in the future.
And there's no doubt, and you see it in the developing world, that organisms, plants that have been modified, they can be modified so they're resistant to drought, they're resistant to insect pests, and that is actually going to be a very, very important criteria as we move into the future. But it's not the sort of horror story of, I don't know, putting genes from pigs into wheat. That's not the sort of thing that is happening. What you are going to see, and increasingly the technology is improving, so that you can actually see something called gene editing, where you have the genetic material from an individual plant, and then you can edit that material so it becomes more resistant to drought, more resistant to pests and diseases, or produces higher yield. And I think that is the sort of hope that I have for improving food production. But it isn't just food. You know, the other key issues as we look into the future are food, water, energy, and of course climate change.
You coined the term perfect storm in 2009 that did incorporate those three issues. That was 8 years ago. Are we still caught in that perfect storm?
Yes, I think we are. And in fact, you know, the storm continues. The reason is the drivers. The first driver is human population. It continues to grow. In the next decade, we'll see another billion people on the planet. give or take about 500 million in Africa and the rest in Asia. You're seeing a major trend away from rural living to city living. You're seeing an increase in prosperity, but at the same time, all of these things drive the demand for food, for water, and for energy. And at the same time also, and this is pretty inexorable, climate change is happening and will continue to happen.
Munich Insurance, you've quoted in your recent talks, has recorded natural disasters increasing over the last 30 years. What do those figures show and their correlation with greenhouse gases?
Well, they're pretty. The correlation is quite strong, but, you know, beware spurious correlations. You know, the number of school teachers and the number of telegraph poles are largely unrelated, but they correlated quite highly. But I think the issue here is that where you are looking to the climate, climate affects weather, and it's weather that we experience. And what is pretty clear is that the weather has become, as climate change develops, significantly more variable. And it's the variability of the weather that has the potential to cause human disasters. There's two factors going on, the variation of weather and also increasing vulnerability of the human population as the population increases, as more people move to the coasts and, for example, become more vulnerable to tropical storms, sea surges, tsunamis and so on.
How do you bring people back into the understanding of the importance of science? It seems to be a dangerous point in history where scientific expertise is being ignored.
Yes, I'm obviously very concerned about it. I think that there is a worry that ignoring scientific advice may lead to significant disasters. And I think I would probably pose a question to those people who are actually ignoring scientific advice. Would you ignore your doctor's advice on particular diseases you have? Would you not take antibiotics to treat an infection? I think there is a reaction in some people that is, I don't want to know about this. Scientists seem to claim they know everything. And I think there's a danger in the scientific community of feeling that they, I suppose we might call it a degree of hubris, that we know more and we know better than the common people. That is not a sensible position for scientists to have. What is a sensible position is to insist that this is the scientific evidence. You may not like it, but that is the evidence. And actually, the predecessor of President Trump, Obama, commented about 2 or 3 years ago that we ignore scientific advice at our peril, especially when it's inconvenient. And I think that's a very shrewd view from a politician.
Sir John Bennington, who was the chief scientist in the United Kingdom for 5 years until 2013, and now a professor of natural resources at Oxford University. He's been in Australia on an agricultural economics conference and was speaking with the ABC's Serena Locke.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Well, let's take a look at what is happening around the Territory's weather today with Hatem Ibrahim. He joins us from the Weather Bureau. G'day.
Good day, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've been enjoying the monsoonal rain in the top end. What's the latest there?
So today we have decent rainfall around the Territory with up to 48 millimetres in Douglas River. And Port Kidd got to 20 millimetres up to from since 9 a.m. this morning, so the last 5 hours or so. So we still have the active monsoon across the base of the top end and near the trough, or just as you go away from the trough, it still have a decent fall affecting the area. So we're expecting that to prevail the next few days. Apart from Darwin and the northern coast, the monsoon will start to ease for a couple of days from tomorrow and day after tomorrow, and then back again with a good northwesterly flow back again to push through the area. So a relief from the rain over Darwin area from tomorrow, with still we got some decent fall or some kind of fall, but not as today and the previous week with the squally shower and something like that. So this is the last day for squally shower for Darwin, and then again tomorrow and day after tomorrow, just isolated shower. Yep.
So we might be able to get some washing dry over the next few days.
Yeah, the next two days, and then again a return for showery and conditions. So just for a short period of time, just tomorrow and day after tomorrow. But in the central top end and southern part of the top end, we still have this trough affecting this area. So we still have a good fall, 20 to 60 millimeters in this area. And with the river that's saturated, or the soil saturated from the previous rainfall, so any amount of falls in this area could as well risk for flash flood in parts of the territory. So we have a flood watch warning for a flood watch warning for the northwest of coastal rivers, and as well moderate flood warning for Daly River, and minor floods for Catherine River and Roper and White Waterhouse. Yep.
And what about in the centre? What's happening around Alice Springs?
Yeah, down south is a different story, as the dry air and southeasterly surge pushed through Alice Springs today. So expecting that temperature relief from the heat wave that was affecting this area. So we're expecting that maximum temperature of Alice Springs 37 today. And so far we got to Alice Springs at 33 now, the maximum temperature. And this cooler change from previous yesterday was report 42 degrees, or 5 degrees less for today, and expecting that to prevail a little bit with maybe increasing in temperatures to high to mid to high 30s over this area, ahead of another good surge in the weekend would drop temperatures to low 30s to mid 30s.
Rightio. Well, we'll look forward to some dry weather in the top end and some slightly cooler weather in the centre.
Cooler weather in the centre, yes, but in Darwin, just a little bit decrease in the amount of rainfall over the northern top. And yeah, again, by Thursday or Friday, we'll start again with a new northwesterly flows or showery conditions affecting the northern part.
Thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you, and have a good day.
You too. That is Hatem Ibrahim, who's been filling us in from the Weather Bureau. You are listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory. Still to come, we'll be telling you why one cattle station near Alice Springs is pulling down its old windmills. And we'll also be heading to South Australia to get the latest from a bull sale there, where one record has been broken.
We probably had high expectations on the bull, and we thought that he had the ability to make a little bit of money, but I think it's probably $100,000 more than where we were thinking he was going to end up.
A trial of genetically modified bananas will go ahead south of Darwin in a few months after approval from the Gene Technology Regulator. 200 modified lines of Cavendish bananas will be grown over 6 hectares in the Litchfield region in hope of developing a variety that's resistant to Panama disease. A similar trial was underway a few years ago, but that came to an abrupt halt when the plants had to be removed under the Banana Freckle Eradication Program. Professor James Dale from the Centre for Tropical Crops and Biocommodities at Queensland University of Technology is leading the banana research program.
The territory was the first place where Fusarium wilt or Panama disease tropical race 4 was found in Australia, and it's had a huge impact on the production of bananas in that region. So a number of years ago, in fact, it was 2012, what we were doing was to look at wild bananas that had resistance to this disease, and we were looking to take genes out of there and put them into Cavendish, which is highly susceptible. We were able to do that, but we couldn't test them in Queensland, obviously, because the disease didn't occur here. And then through a collaboration in 2012, we planted our first field trial testing out these bananas for resistance to Tropical Race 4.
What was the outcome of that trial?
Well, the trial ran for 3 years. The only reason we stopped it was that we had to take the bananas out because of the freckle eradication program. The outcome was we found four lines of Cavendish Grand Nain, which had either complete or very high levels of resistance. So it was pretty exciting. But it was only a small number of plants. So that's very much part of what we're planning to do next.
So what you learnt in that previous trial, you're starting to bring back and ramp up.
That's right, yeah. So we're now taking those four lines that look very promising and doing a much larger number of plants and a much bigger area, as well as bringing up new lines with the same gene in to see whether we can get even better resistance.
So how many lines would you say all up?
We're probably ultimately going to look at around about 200 lines.
And how many plants each?
The four lines we're taking up, we're going to do 50 plants per line. And for the new ones, we're going to do between 15 and 20 plants per line.
And has that license from the Gene Technology Regulator been approved?
It has been, yes. Yes, indeed. Bananas are probably the safest of all the possible GM crops because they're essentially, they're big and they're essentially sterile. So there's no chance of these genes moving out of the plant that they're in. I could grow a non-GM banana right next to a GM banana and the genes won't move from one to the other. At the end of the trial, what we do is we hit all the bananas with herbicide, Roundup, and then once they've all died, plough them in. And then that land is left vacant for a significant period of time to make sure that there aren't any bananas coming up.
When does the trial begin in the Territory?
We're hoping it's going to be first half of this year. We're multiplying the plants up and just finalising all of the regulatory requirements at the moment. They go up and they take a while. They've got to be acclimatised before we plant them.
And it's a five-year project?
Yeah, we want to run it for at least 5 years, yes, because we want to make sure that these bananas, if they're resistant, are resistant over a long period.
And who are going to be the main beneficiaries of the outcomes of this trial?
Well, that's an interesting question. At the moment, clearly there are no GM bananas being commercially grown in Australia because none of them have been deregulated. The most likely first GM bananas to be deregulated are probably going to be in Uganda, and that's either our bananas, the ones we're working with in collaboration, or bananas resistant to a disease called bacterial wilt, Xanthomonas bacterial wilt, in Uganda. So they're the most advanced. Our bananas, it's very much, I think, if the disease becomes really serious in Queensland, and at the moment they've done a fabulous job at containing it, then there would be a real possibility to take our bananas through to deregulation in Australia.
Now, where are these initial banana plants being grown out, and, you know, where is the modifications taking place?
That all takes place in Brisbane in our labs at QUT. So we do the modification or transformation, as we call it. We select the plants, and this is all in vitro. This is all in tissue culture. We multiply them up, and then we take them up the Northern Territory in vitro. So they're still in tissue culture when we take them out of Queensland. And then we go up from time to time to do the assessments. But this trial's a bit bigger, so we'll probably be employing people specifically. So I'm employing people in the Northern Territory specifically to assess the trial on an ongoing basis.
How does that assessment look? What is done when you go into the paddock to have a look at these plants?
So all of the characteristics of the banana, the normal characteristics, will be assessed, including yield and you know, number of hands and number of fingers and all those sorts of things are very important. Recording when the first symptoms, because we'll have controls up there, of course, that are highly susceptible, that just the normal Grand Nain or Williams, and this time we're doing both Grand Nain and Williams, to assess the level of disease, when they become infected, etc., and also doing the molecular diagnostics to demonstrate that the symptoms that we're seeing are actually caused by this tropical race fall.
So do you have a theory, the four lines of Cavendish plus the extra ones you're bringing up? Is there a particular line you think is the one to watch?
We've got one of the four lines, which it looks terrific. So we're hoping it continues to look terrific. But the new lines, we have no idea because we haven't taken them. They haven't been in the field before. We've got ways now of being able to screen those early to give us an idea of how good they're going to be. But the proof is very much in the field. That's one of the essentials with working with bananas. They have to perform in the field.
So the trial is about bringing bananas up here that have been transformed. They have an additional gene that hopefully will offer a resistance to Panama disease. Those banana plants you just let grow and you wait for the time that Panama will naturally occur in that plantation.
That's right, yes.
Professor James Dale, who's leading the banana research program at Queensland University of Technology, he was speaking there with Lisa Herbert. You are listening to the Country Hour. It's 2:45. Well, they're a staple on many an outback cattle station, but in central Australia, some of the windmills are on the way out. At Undulia Station, they're being replaced with solar power. It's been something the station's been working on for a while, and as Ben Hayes explains, it's much more efficient.
We've just been pulling the gear out of the windmills and putting solar pumps down, just building my own solar array, like the frames and everything, and just running them down on lay flat. And, just found them so much more efficient and a lot easier to handle. The one I pulled out the other day, it was an old mono windmill. The mill's still there. And I pulled the mono gear out and just been replacing the mono gear with the solars.
And that type of windmill is pretty rare?
Yeah, that type of wheel is very... You don't see too many of them around. I reckon there's one at Tennant Creek. I've got one. Might be a couple at D Rose and a couple might be at Derwent. But you don't see them too often.
How far along are you in the process? How many windmills have you changed over so far?
Yeah, no, I've done a few so far. I just like them for the ease of maintenance on them. Only thing that worries me is we're running electricity into water and we've always been told not to. That's a concern. I don't understand that yet, but I'll get my head around that, and once I do, I'll be right.
And when did you first start looking at changing over?
I probably started about 15-odd year ago, and the technology and the price of them has come back so much that it's a given that you might as well do it. So, and I'm having such like good season, good prices, so I might as well be putting a bit of bucks back into the property.
It's a good opportunity, I suppose, to, do those little odd jobs that have been on the back burner for a while.
Yeah, that's right. I'd like to, get it up and going and do those sort of things while I can, which is what I've been doing.
How old are some of the windmills that you've been changing over?
Some of the mills that I've been taking out and dropping on the ground and everything, they date back to sort of the late 40s, early 50s, which my grandfather put up. We'd getting rid of them and putting solar in now.
Does that, change the authenticity or the look of the classic windmill?
Yeah, it does. It's a funny thing because some of them we've been just cutting down and dropping on the ground and cutting them up and using the steel out of the windmills into yards and stuff. And it just seems bloody strange coming up to a bore with no mill there anymore. It just seems you nearly get lost.
And how big of a difference have you noticed in terms of how efficient they are since you've started changing over?
They've been great for me. Fuel costs. I've got rid of the fuel costs. My old man and I, we were talking one day about it, and he said a windmill's pumping 24 hours a day on a windy day, whereas your solar's only pumping you 12 hours a day. But I said to him, well, I reckon that's wrong. I said, because out of the 24 hours a day, he's going down the hole on your draw plunger half of that time. So half the time, for the 12 hours, he's going back down the hole dragging water back up. So he's not pumping 24 hours a day. And he said, oh, I never looked at it that way. So, yeah, that's why I like solar. Solar's just continuous flow. And these Grundfos pumps that we've been putting in, they're great because the technology in them is really good. Because you can go there, and if you need be, you can hook a generator up to them, fire it up in the evening. It'll run all night until you run out of fuel if you have to, and you don't have to go back to the next day and flick any switches. It'll automatically kick into solar for you, so which is great for me so far.
Will you be looking to change any more over in the next little while?
Yeah, I will be. I'd like to have it eventually all solar, but yeah, it's just you got a few costings and stuff to do. But no, I'm heading there.
So you're modernising some of the windmills. Are you using solar for any other aspects of the property that weren't solar before?
Yeah, I've got my auto drafting my steers and that's running on solar. I'm actually toying with the idea of making a like a bugle yard with automated drafting in it, involve running running on solar panels and stuff. So yeah, I'm thinking of different things to use solar for. We also wouldn't mind trialling a calf cradle that runs on solar, like a electric over hydraulic with using solar. So yeah, we're trying different things.
And when you changed the solar over on the mono windmill, that everyone was out there, there were some pictures on social media. Does everyone get involved when you're out there doing the jobs like that?
Yeah, we do. It's been good. We've been all getting into it and having a crack. It's part of the makeup down here, like it's a family-owned place, so everybody's got to have a go.
Ben Hayes from Undoolia Station speaking with Katrina Bevan. Up next on the Country Hour, we'll be getting the latest on a record-breaking bull sale in South Australia. Runga on the Country Hour. A Simmental bull from South Australia's southeast has sold for $160,000, smashing the previous breed record. That price is more than three times the previous record for a Simmental bull and sets a new Australian record for a Bos Taurus bull. But it still doesn't go close to the national record of $300,000 paid for a Brahman bull in 2006. The bull, Woonalee, Los Angeles, was bred by Tom Baker at the Woonalee Simmentals in Ferner, South Australia. He told Karen Hunt he's still getting over the shock.
Yeah, it's pretty surreal, really. It's one of those things that we probably had high expectations on the bull, and we thought that he had the ability to make a little bit of money, but I think it's probably $100,000 more than where we were thinking he was going to end up. So it is quite amazing, and it's wonderful for us. It's also great for the Simmental breed.
Is this an Australian record for all bulls?
No, it would be Australian record for Bos taurus bulls. There has been Bos indicus bulls make more than that.
What do you think has prompted such a high price to be paid for the bull?
He's a pretty unique individual physically, I suppose. He's a tremendous bull with a huge amount of performance capacity and all blended into a polled sire, which is pretty rare to have that performance and polled as well. He's the first son to sell out of a new bull called Glen Anthony Waiata, which is quite attractive to people, and he's also the result of an embryo out of our very best cow. So I suppose it's one of those things where the stars aligned and the phenotype and the genetic capability of the bull is quite amazing.
Do you think it also reflects something of the state of the beef industry at the moment?
Oh, I've got no doubt that the beef industry is in uncharted waters, and I do believe that it's probably gives people confidence to look into these high-end sires and spend a little bit more money than they previously had.
And where is this bull headed to?
He's off to Queensland, to Brett Nobbs, NCC, Brahmins and Simmental. So he goes up to Brett, who's just starting out in the Simmental industry and wanted to start with the best, and there's no doubt about that, he has done that.
What does this sort of recognition, this publicity, do for a stud like yours?
I think it's one of those things that gives us great confidence to really push harder into this breed. We've been at the forefront of trying to push the Simmental breed into recognition within the beef industry. It's obviously a smaller breed that doesn't necessarily have the promotion and the upside than some other breeds, but I think for us it just gives us great confidence to keep pushing the way and paving the way for the future in both the traditional coloured Simmentals as well as the black Simmentals as well.
That's bull breeder Tom Hunt speaking to Karen Hunt. Now let's head to the markets at South Australia. The Dublin cattle sale was today. John Traeger was there.
Good afternoon. Numbers remain similar to the previous week, with agents offering 173 head of lightweight and open oxen cattle. The usual trade and processor buyers were joined by an additional Victorian processor, with feeders and restockers very active throughout the sale. Prices generally remain firm week on week for type and condition, with quality in the velar section better than average. Velar steers traded from 308 to 380 cents to restockers, while trade sales range from 308 to 350 cents a kilo. Velar heifers traded from 280 to 350 cents, with the majority returning to the paddock, while trade sales peaked at 338 cents a kilo. Medium weight yearling steers were keenly sought by restockers and feeders at rates from 272 to 350 cents, with the trade sales ranging from 286 to 318 cents. Yearling steers over 400 kilos sold to prices at rates from 270 to 310 cents a kilo. Medium weight yearling heifers ranged from 290 to 330 cents, with a few heavyweights on offer selling at 280 cents a kilo. Beef bred drone steers range from 266 to 308 cents, with the four manufacturing steers on offer realising 270 cents a kilo. Light dairy cows range from 122 to 160 cents, with medium weight selling from 120 to 160 cents also. Light beef bred cows traded from 186 to 218 cents, with the heavier descriptions trading from 180 cents to 248 cents a kilo. Light younger bulls to restockers traded from 324 to 350 cents, with trade sales ranging from 242 to 312 cents a kilo. This has been John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks for that, John. That's just about it for the Country Hour, but coming up on your radio after the 2 o'clock news is Lorella Cochrane. Lorella, what have you got for us?
Well, we're talking about grog. It's always an interest of mine. And moderation.
And mine.
Apparently, drinking in moderation is just as bad for you as drinking heavily.
Right. So go all out then if you...
Well, that's one interpretation, but we'll have that conversation after 2 o'clock.
That is coming up on your radio after 2 o'clock. Don't forget, you can always jump online for any of our stories and stories from the Country Hour team right across Australia. Just head online to abc.net.au/rural. You can also podcast the program at any time where you normally get your podcasts, or you can download the ABC Radio app. I've got it and it is absolutely brilliant. Can't recommend it enough. My name's Stephen Schubert. I'll be in the studio with you for the rest of the week. I'll talk to you tomorrow.